Hello, knowledge seekers. In this episode of 20 Minute Books, we delve into Talking to My Daughter About the Economy by Yanis Varoufakis, a world-renowned economist and former Minister of Finance in Greece. This profound book offers a clear and engaging overview of the complex world of economics, presented in a way that is both digestible and deeply informative. Varoufakis sets out to demystify how economic forces shape our world by addressing the subject in the form of a letter to his daughter. This unique approach not only simplifies abstract concepts, but also highlights the relevance of economics in daily life. Whether you are a political enthusiast eager to understand economic theory, or an everyday citizen looking to engage more deeply with the economic currents that flow beneath the surface of global politics, this book promises to provide valuable insights. Join us as we break down the essential elements of our economic system through the insightful perspective of Yanis Varoufakis. Talking to My Daughter About the Economy, A Brief History of Capitalism. Introduction. Exploring economics through simple conversations. Economics often sounds like a mix of intimidating jargon, yield curves, default swaps, aggregate demand, to name a few. For many, just these terms can be enough to switch off interest. However, understanding the economic principles shaping our world is crucial, especially as we navigate a complex economic landscape. In Talking to My Daughter About the Economy, Yanis Varoufakis takes on the challenge of demystifying these complex concepts. Why did he write this book? The answer is simple: to make the intricate world of economics accessible even to his young daughter, ensuring she and readers like her can grasp the basics before their teen years. This discussion isn't just a lecture, it's a father's attempt to contextualize and explain a world that his daughter will inherit. And through this engaging family dialogue, Varoufakis covers the essentials of our financial systems, from the origin of money to how market operations dominate our lives, and what might be done to make economics serve society broadly and fairly. In this conversationally styled narrative, you'll see why something as simple as an iPad and a traditional dish like moussaka can illustrate modern economic principles, how items as ordinary as cigarettes could function as a currency in certain economies, and how the rise of automation could potentially disrupt our economic stability. Varoufakis's narrative makes it clear: learning about economics doesn't have to be daunting. It can be as simple and engaging as talking to a child. Part 1. How agricultural advances fueled global disparities. Back in January 1788, a fleet of 11 British ships arrived on the shores of Australia, initiating a series of events that would dramatically alter the landscape and its native population, the Aborigines. This moment in history poses an intriguing question: why was it the British who colonized Australia and not the other way around? The answer does not lie in any supposed superiority of the Europeans over the Aborigines, but rather in the differing material conditions under which each society evolved. The British had developed agriculture, which fundamentally changed their society's structure and capabilities. The core insight here is: agricultural surpluses laid the groundwork for modern economic inequalities. So, how exactly did agriculture propel Europe towards global conquests? It all began about 12,000 years ago with the agricultural revolution. For the first time, humans could produce more food than necessary for immediate survival. This surplus wasn't just a nutritional boon, it sparked a series of innovations to manage and preserve this excess. The consequences of agriculture were profound. It necessitated the construction of buildings for storage, the invention of writing for record keeping, and the establishment of guards to protect these goods. Moreover, surpluses enabled trade to flourish, evolving from simple barter systems to complex transactions involving tokens that represented stored or even yet to be produced surpluses, paving the way for the concepts of money and credit. However, for money to function, societal belief in its value was essential, and maintaining this belief often required enforcing mechanisms, such as bureaucracies to manage the money and armies to back its value. This led to the emergence of a class of individuals who controlled the wealth without directly contributing to its creation, setting the stage for hierarchical societal structures. In sharp contrast, the Aborigines lived in a society where subsistence from hunting and gathering made accumulation of material surplus unnecessary. They developed rich cultural traditions in poetry, music, and myth, but lacked the material means to enforce dominance over others. European societies, driven by their agricultural surplus, developed ideologies that justified their economic and social structures, viewing their advancements not merely as achievements, but as evidences of their inherent right to dominate. Thus, when the British arrived in Australia, they did so with the conviction that the land was theirs to claim, backed by their material and military might. This mindset, shaped by their agricultural past, forged a path of inequality that continues to influence global relations today. Part 2: How market value has overshadowed life's simple treasures. Picture a lovely Easter Sunday gathering. Your family is around the dinner table, enjoying moussaka and sharing laughter under the warm glow of the afternoon sun. These moments, filled with joy and homemade delicacies, hold immense personal value. But are these moments marketable, like the gadgets and gizmos available on Amazon? Clearly not. The delicious moussaka made by your grandmother is crafted for enjoyment and sharing, not for sale. Its value lies in its use. On the other hand, products you purchase online, a watch or an iPad, are commodities. They possess what economists call exchange value. In today's world, unfortunately, it is this exchange value that often dominates. The underlying message here is, in our market-driven society, exchange value often trumps all else. This term, market society, is thrown around because market logic dictates almost every aspect of our lives. Everything has a price tag: the home you live in, the ground it's built on, and even your personal time and effort are all valued for their market potential. Historically, this wasn't always the case. Consider Europe during the Middle Ages before industrialization. Markets existed but didn't govern life. For instance, land was inherited and managed by lords, not bought and sold. Serfs worked the land not for a paycheck, but as a feudal obligation, and in return, they received protection, not payment. Here, there weren't prices, but a system of duties and privileges. However, this structure began to change around the 1500s with the rise of global trade. Merchants started generating wealth by trading tangible goods like wool with distant markets. Lords noticed that food grown by peasants was consumed rather than sold, which did not generate surplus wealth. Spurred by the potential for profit, many lords evicted peasants to use the lands for more profitable, marketable commodities like wool. The shift was monumental. Land began to be evaluated in terms of exchange value. Displaced peasants, stripped of their ability to produce food, were forced to sell their labor, marking the beginning of labor as a commodity. The Industrial Revolution accelerated this transformation, ushering in an era where labor markets formed and people sold their time to survive, perpetually tethered to the cycle of earning and spending within these commodified systems. As a result, our society gradually oriented itself around the dynamics of the market, often sidelining the intrinsic values of life's simple, unmarketable joys. Part 3: The relentless cycle of debt and desire for profit in our market economy. Imagine you're a medieval serf who has just been evicted from your land by a lord eager to profit from wool production. Now, without land, you decide to join the burgeoning market economy, not as a laborer in dingy coal mines, but as a wool producer. However, to start this venture, you face initial financial hurdles. Land lease, sheep purchase, and employee wages all demand capital, more than you have in hand. Enter the local financier, ready to lend you the money at a steep interest rate. Reluctantly, you accept, catapulting yourself from a serf to an indebted entrepreneur. Your new goal? Make a profit. Here's the central idea. Debt serves as the engine driving the unending pursuit of profit within market societies. Historically, communal exchanges involved mutual aid, helping each other without formal agreements, expecting that the favor would be returned in kind when needed. Contrastingly, debt introduces a rigid structure to these exchanges. It not only formalizes the reciprocation through contracts, specifying repayments in exact amounts, but also adds interest, extra value to be paid over and above the principal amount. In a market-driven world, debt becomes a common starting step for most non-wealthy entrepreneurs who need to invest in production, and with the obligation of interest, breaking even doesn't cut it. Turning a profit is imperative. To succeed, and more importantly, to survive, an entrepreneur must efficiently outmaneuver competitors. This involves reducing operational costs, often at the expense of wages, and investing heavily in productivity-enhancing resources. Our hypothetical wool producer, now an entrepreneur, is thrust into this relentless cycle, accruing debt, generating profit to cover interest, and minimizing costs, all to stay afloat. This dynamic fosters a wealth accumulation for lenders at one end and a stressful financial existence for entrepreneurial and working classes at the other. Interestingly, while many religions historically regarded debt, and especially usury, lending money at high interest rates, as unethical, the rise of market society has weakened these prohibitions, aligning moral stances with economic practices driven by material needs and benefits. Thus, debt isn't just a financial tool but a cornerstone that shapes the foundational dynamics of our market society, continuously fostering a culture where profit-seeking becomes not just a motive but a necessity for survival. Part 4. The paradox of bank failures and personal financial risk. Imagine this. You secure a business loan for $1 million. It might seem like this vast sum is being pulled from a massive vault, but in reality, the bank simply alters your account balance, essentially creating money from nothing. This newly created $1 million is contingent upon your promise to repay it, with added interest and fees flowing back to the bank. As banks proliferate loans, their profits escalate through these fees. This dynamic incentivizes a high volume of loans, regardless of the quality or risk associated with them. Yet, what transpires when these loans aren't repaid? Do banks suffer as you might if you were unable to meet your financial obligations? The stark reality in our market societies is this. Banks are structured to withstand failures that would typically devastate individuals. Herein lies the essential message. In market systems, banks are safeguarded against collapse, unlike individuals. Money's constant flow is crucial for a functioning economy, and banks catalyze this by distributing loans and assuming the related debts. This system can function beneficially, allowing more businesses to operate and profit. However, driven by profit motives, banks might issue increasingly risky loans. This risk accumulates until debtors default, potentially triggering a crisis where the banks themselves are threatened with insolvency, incapable of fulfilling withdrawal demands from depositors. This scenario prompts a panicky rush for cash withdrawals, leading to what we know as a bank run. Such crises have the potential to cripple the broader economy, necessitating state intervention through bailouts. These are essentially loans from the government to the banks to stabilize them, as seen during the 2008 U.S. housing market crash. While theoretically the government could impose strict regulations or penalize irresponsible bankers as part of these bailouts, financial and political realities often intertwine. Bankers and financial entities wield considerable influence over political actors through campaign contributions and other means, reducing the likelihood of punitive measures. This dynamic offers banks a uniquely advantageous position. They profit in economically prosperous times by leveraging fees and interests from loans, and during downturns they are often rescued by governmental bailouts, essentially funded by taxpayers. This system underscores a significant imbalance where banks may be shielded from financial repercussions while individuals bear the brunt of economic risks and personal failures. Part 5. Understanding the unique dynamics of labor and money in the market. Imagine two individuals facing market challenges. Wassily, a well-trained economist struggling to find employment, and Andreas, who can't seem to sell his beautiful summer home in Patmos. Both are sellers in their own right, but are encountering difficulties in finding buyers. You might wonder, is it a simple issue of pricing? Partially, yes. If Andreas slashed his beach house price to, say, $10, he'd likely have buyers lining up. A bargain-priced island retreat is universally appealing. But what about Wassily? If he dramatically reduced his salary expectations to the same amount, would employers rush to hire him? Surprisingly, not really. This brings us to an important insight. Labor and money aren't just ordinary commodities. They're governed by a distinct set of rules. Labor, unlike a tangible asset like a house, doesn't offer experiential value. It's a means to an end. An employer won't hire workers unless there's a clear need that justifies the investment, irrespective of how low the cost of labor might go. For example, a refrigerator manufacturer won't hire more staff unless there's actual demand for more refrigerators. Extra labor, no matter how cheap, becomes a liability without demand. Similarly, money operates under special conditions. Money typically changes hands, through borrowing, for instance, not for its own sake, but as a means to generate further income. Borrowers take on loans with the belief that this influx of cash will lead to profit, such as through expansion of business operations or purchasing crucial equipment. Even if interest rates are low, without the potential for profit, borrowing money doesn't make sense. What does this imply for our market-driven society? Essentially, both labor and capital, money, hinge significantly on consumer demand. During economic downturns, when consumer confidence and spending plummet, businesses halt hiring and investment. This, in turn, exacerbates the economic slowdown. No hiring leads to less income, spiraling into diminished consumer spending and demand. Therefore, advice often given during recessions, to reduce wages to increase employment, doesn't hold up. Lower wages mean less consumer spending, which further depresses business revenues and hampers economic recovery. It's somewhat paradoxical. The downsizing intended to save costs and stimulate employment actually does the opposite. Labor and money markets, thus, are not just ruled by supply and demand, but are deeply influenced by expectations and confidence, akin to self-fulfilling prophecies where pessimism can drive downturns and optimism can spur growth. Part 6. The double-edged sword of automation in our economy. Visualize a time in the early 1800s where your livelihood comes from working in a cotton mill. Suddenly, your world is turned upside down as your employer introduces a steam-powered loom that can outproduce any human effort. You, along with many others, are rendered jobless. Some, in their desperation and anger, resort to smashing these machines, a reaction historically known from the Luddites, a group of British workers who resisted automation by destroying the machinery that threatened their jobs. While often portrayed as antagonists to progress, the Luddites' resistance might have inadvertently delayed economic recessions spurred by rapid technological advances. Here's the crucial takeaway. In market-driven societies, increased automation isn't necessarily a universal solution. The allure of automation from a business perspective is quite clear. It promises reduced production costs and increased profits. For instance, replacing human laborers with a machine in a fabric factory slashes payroll expenses significantly, initially boosting profitability. However, this is only a temporary advantage. As competitors adopt similar technologies to cut costs, a cycle of price reduction and further automation ensues, driven by the need to stay competitive. This relentless pursuit of efficiency, driven by automation, often culminates in products becoming exceedingly cheap. While this might seem beneficial, it can destabilize the economy. The reason is that as more jobs are automated, Fewer workers receive salaries to purchase goods like fabric. Thus, despite lower production costs, the purchasing power of consumers diminishes, brewing a potential market collapse. Yet, this scenario isn't an inevitable outcome of automation. The prevailing system, where profits from automation flow exclusively to a select few, exacerbates economic inequality and instability. If, however, the benefits of automation were distributed more equitably, say if workers or community members owned shares in the automated enterprises, profits could be shared amongst those displaced by machines. This would sustain consumer purchasing power and avert potential market crashes. In such an inclusive setup, even as automation displaces traditional jobs, it could also foster a new type of economy where profits generated by increased efficiency benefit everyone, not just the owners. This approach keeps the economy dynamic and stable, ensuring that automation serves as a tool for collective advancement rather than a catalyst for economic instability. Part 7, Democratizing Money, the Political Underpinnings of Currency Value. Consider the diverse mediums of exchange humanity has utilized throughout history. From gold and shells to banknotes and coins, the items we've chosen to symbolize value are varied. During World War II in POW camps, cigarettes emerged as an improbable form of currency. Donated monthly by the Red Cross, these cigarettes were valuable because they were desired, portable, and storable, making them perfect makeshift money in an enclosed environment like a camp. Inside these camps, the value of a cigarette would fluctuate based on availability. More supply from the Red Cross meant a cigarette could get you less, say a chocolate, while scarcity meant it could fetch much more. This dynamic showcases a basic economic principle of supply influencing value. Outside of such controlled environments, money operates similarly, yet with a critical distinction. The forces controlling supply are not neutral arbitrators like the Red Cross, but profoundly political entities. Here lies the critical insight. The value of money is inherently political, and thus it is crucial to democratize its control. The agreed-upon value of money, its acceptance as a medium for transaction, hinges on its endorsement by the state, underscored by the images of rulers and national emblems imprinted on coins and notes. This establishes that money is not just an economic tool, but also a symbol of political authority and control. Moreover, the management of money's value involves regulating its supply. Inflation occurs when too much money chases too few goods, diluting its worth. Conversely, deflation occurs when there's too little money in circulation, enhancing its value disproportionately. These dynamics show that whoever controls the money supply wields significant power. Typically, this authority rests with central banks, which, despite theoretical independence, often maintain symbiotic relationships with government and commercial banks. This nexus of power can lead to policies that prioritize the interests of the wealthy, such as easy facilitation of bailouts for banks, while public interest projects that benefit the broader society, like infrastructure development, might face financial neglect. This scenario isn't unchangeable. Much like other economic systems, the control of money's supply and value can be reformed to reflect more democratic principles. If the process of money creation was subject to democratic scrutiny and control, its distribution could potentially align more closely with the broader public interest, ensuring that monetary policy serves all segments of society rather than the economic elite. This realization calls for a significant transformation in how we perceive and govern our financial systems, shifting the control of money to a more participative and transparent paradigm. Part 8. How exchange value dominates and endangers our natural world. Envision a lush pine forest sprawling across the Peloponnese mountainsides, a place of natural beauty and tranquility where the air is filled with the scent of sap and the sounds of birds. What is the true value of this forest? Is it the sheer aesthetic and ecological benefits it provides, or is it the potential revenue from selling its timber? Regrettably, within our market-driven society, it's the latter that often takes precedence. Forests and other natural resources are predominantly seen through the lens of potential profit. They are assessed not for their intrinsic or ecological worth, but for their exchange value, the price their commodified elements can fetch in the market. Herein lies a profound issue. Our society's fixation on exchange value is jeopardizing the planet. This relentless pursuit compels businesses and individuals to maximize commodity extraction and sales, often overlooking sustainability. This can be seen in practices ranging from rampant deforestation to the unsustainable mining of minerals and burning of fossil fuels, each contributing to environmental degradation. Is there a way to halt this ecological destruction? Several strategies might help. One method involves implementing laws that recognize and protect the intrinsic value of ecosystems, as Ecuador has attempted by recognizing the rights of nature in its constitution. However, such legislative efforts are sporadic and often countered by powerful business interests. Alternatively, assigning a monetary penalty to environmental harm, such as a carbon tax, proposes that businesses pay for the right to pollute. This model aims to reduce emissions by making pollution costly. However, the effectiveness of this strategy depends heavily on rigorous implementation and enforcement, elements that can be compromised by the very governments that rely on corporate support. Perhaps a more radical yet necessary approach would be to democratize control over natural resources, instead of a few wealthy executives deciding whether to drill for oil or invest in renewable energy. Imagine if the broader community had a say. People affected by environmental decisions, like those in coastal areas facing rising sea levels, could collectively opt for sustainable practices over destructive ones. By shifting decision-making from a handful of profit-driven entities to a more democratic and community-focused approach, we might find a path that values our environment, not just for what it can be sold for, but for what it truly is. Vital to the health and future of our planet and its inhabitants. This communal involvement could steer us toward a future where the market serves the planet rather than exploits it. Final summary. The essence of our modern global economy can aptly be characterized as a market society, a realm where the forces of the market pervasively influence nearly every aspect of life. In this context, everything from precious natural resources to human labor is commodified, assessed primarily for its potential to yield profit. This treatment extends to time, effort, and even environmental elements, all viewed through the lens of economic utility. Yet, it's crucial to recognize that this system is neither natural nor inevitable. Its prevalence is the result of specific historical, political, and economic decisions that have prioritized market values over others. By re-examining and potentially restructuring ownership models and value systems, we can steer the economy toward principles that emphasize democracy and fairness. This shift entails redefining what we value, not just in financial terms, but in terms of community well-being, sustainability, and ethical governance. By reshaping these fundamental aspects, we pave the way for an economic system that aligns more closely with democratic ideals, ensuring that the economy serves the broad society rather than the select few. This reimagined framework can foster an environment where the market is a tool for public good, not a governable force dictating the limits of possible societal achievements. Thank you for joining me today on this journey of learning and discovery as we explored the insights of another thought-provoking book in our growing library of knowledge. If you've enjoyed our time together, please take a moment to follow our podcast, give us a 5-star rating, and share 20-minute books with other knowledge seekers. Your support truly means a lot. Don't forget to join me again in the next episode, where we will delve into another enriching book. Until then, happy reading and happy listening.